My name is Jody Kretzman, and when I am not here at Holden Village, I reside in Chicago, which is a fairly political town, some of you may have heard. This is a session in which I'm going to lead off sharing a few ruminations about the 88 elections and then invite all of you to enter into a discussion about what really is at stake in particularly the national elections this time around. See if at this particular point, positioned between the Democratic and Republican conventions, we can make some sense of our public life together. Just a word or two about perspectives and biases that I carry into this discussion. I think that what I need to confess to is being a political junkie. I'm absolutely addicted to the political process. I think it's one of the prerequisites, actually, for living in Chicago. Certainly for surviving there for very long. This has been, since I've been in Holden here this time, since early June, this has been one of the hardest summers of my life. I have never been as far from the political conventions as I am up here. I have never been in a position where I've had to wait in an election year for the newspapers to come up a day or two late. This is like water torture to me. There certainly hasn't been a Democratic convention since 1968 that I haven't either attended or been absolutely glued to the media about. So I need to confess that addiction before I get going. I'm almost equally addicted to Republican politics. But because Chicago, until recently, had no Republicans, I'm more acquainted with Democratic politics than I am with Republican politics. The Chicago Tribune a couple of times has referred to me as a political operative, which I think is a term in the Tribune's lexicon, which ranks right up there with Cook County Jail inmate as a sort of label to put on somebody. But I also have done a lot of policy work, particularly with the Democratic Party locally and nationally, and I write about politics sometimes in an academic kind of framework as well. Well, so those are some of the kind of interests and a little bit of backdrop on me. What I'd like to do at this point is to ask us to step back a little bit from the day-to-day events, which we have to do anyway, since we don't know what the day-to-day events are here at Holden, and to think about some overall kinds of categories of approaching what's going on and what's important in the 88 elections. I want to talk a little bit about strategies and about substance and about symbols in that order, and then have time for some interchange at the end. First, strategies. I'm starting with strategies rather than the substance of the elections or the symbolic kind of import of the elections, because strategies is what it gets the focus of the media for the most part. The media like to cover elections mostly as horse races between personalities. They like to count votes, base their coverage on polls, and talk about strategies as if, in fact, what we're witnessing is a sporting event rather than the unfolding of a political agenda. So I'll start with strategies too, just because that's what the media has taught us to do. And let me start by asking a question that political scientists ask every 4 years. And it's an interesting question to think about because it asks us to step back a little bit. Some political scientists like to think about pivotal elections or benchmark elections. That is, elections which are not just sort of run-of-the-mill every 4 year elections, but elections that somehow encompass a kind of massive movement of the country. Some kind of indicator in the electoral process that there's a kind of plate tectonics going on in the U.S. society, that there's a kind of massive shift of constituencies, that agendas are shifting, that in some way the particular election embodies a much broader set of changes in the American society. So political scientists every 4 years ask the question, is this a pivotal election? Is this a benchmark election? They have in mind, for instance, elections like 1932, with the election of, just to name a couple in the last 50 or 60 years, with the election of Franklin Roosevelt, when you had a massive shift from a kind of laissez-faire early 20th century capitalism to really the beginning of a kind of state capitalism, to a response to the Depression in the early 30s that redefined the role of the state, that redefined the role of the federal government in ways that impact our lives even up to today. So 1932 is clearly a pivotal or benchmark election. Some political scientists think that 1960 may have been also, but more political scientists, I think, are convinced that 1968 was sort of our most recent pivotal or benchmark election. The New Deal Coalition, which was put together first by FDR in the 1930s for the Democrats, involved a series of constituencies in the United States, which really did last, even during the Eisenhower years, all the way into the 1960s. Think about who it was that maintained the Democratic Party from really 32 onward. It is a strange collection of people. It was in the Democratic Party was based on certainly the black community, the solid Democratic South, white ethnics, and the urban vote. That coalition lasted until 1968. As you all recall, 1968 was an incredibly tumultuous year in all of American society, with the assassination of Dr. King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the decision by Lyndon Johnson not to run again, both escalating involvement and escalating protest around Vietnam, this sort of peaking of civil rights, and then black power, and then urban rebellion expressions in black communities across the country. 68 sort of encapsulated a variety of tensions in the United States, and the result of all that in the electoral realm was that a Republican, Richard Nixon, beat out Hubert Humphrey in the presidency. And the fracturing of that, what turned out to be quite fragile at that point, Democratic coalition built in the 1930s, the fracturing of that coalition began in earnest. As particularly the South left the Democratic Party and moved over into the Republican Party, at least for the next little while, and particularly, of course, the white South. That new realignment of Republican power from 1968 on really has lasted, I think, all the way through the 80s, most political scientists would say, and I certainly agree. That is, the Republicans under Nixon and Ford, and certainly in the 1980s under Reagan, with just a kind of parentheses of Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s, the Republicans have managed to keep together a coalition that took enough away from that old New Deal coalition of the Democrats to keep themselves in power. They have the South, particularly the white South, has continued to deliver electoral votes for the Republicans, certainly through the 1980s. That, combining with the new power of the Southwest and West, has been enough to keep the Republicans in power. So 68 is the aftermath of 68 is still where we're living politically. Still where we're living politically, it seems to me. The question about 1988, then, is this another one of those pivotal or benchmark elections? I think that that's the kind of question that you can't answer until about 10 years down the pipe. But it does seem to me at least possible that 1988 might be one of those kinds of pivotal or benchmark elections. It could be that the Democrats, this time around, have put together a set of strategies that begins to splinter in some way the Reagan version of the Republican coalition that was put together in 1968. Certainly, that's what Michael Dukakis' strategy is all about. As he thinks about the necessary 270 votes, I think basically, geographically, what he's trying to do is to figure out a way to put together the northwest section of the country, where we are now, with the northeast section of the country, to add California and Texas, right? And to add enough of the Midwest industrial and farming states, where both the industrial and the farming economy have had terrific difficulties over the last 8 years, to put together enough of those pieces to get his 270 votes. It's not an easy addition process to get into at this point. We have to remember that Mondale in 84, I think, took Minnesota, Massachusetts, and Washington, D.C., I think, and that's it. The question is, as Dukakis thinks about where those 270 votes are coming from, can he put together a strategy that puts enough of the pieces on the table in those key areas to be able to carry it? Let's look at it non-geographically. It seems to me that Dukakis is counting on a solid black vote that is up at least 10 or 15%, and that is more important in some parts of the country than in others, but that he's counting on the Jackson phenomenon to deliver that black vote. It seems to me that Dukakis clearly is counting on at least 75% Hispanic vote, which is particularly key in California and Texas for those big electoral vote blocks. And it's interesting to note that the Dukakis and Benson team are the only team of people who both speak Spanish, right, that we've ever had, certainly running for president and vice president. And I think that was probably not only a little on Dukakis' mind when he picked Benson. And he's, I think, again with the Benson choice, counting on breaking apart a little bit some of that southern strength of the Republican Party in the last 20 years. And particularly the combination of having a southerner with conservative credentials like Benson on the ticket, combined with the continuing spillover charisma of Jesse Jackson to bring in both black votes and some of the old white Democratic votes from the South to carry it possibly at least some of the border states. It's also clear to me that in thinking about both the South and the Midwest, and to some degree I think the Northeast, Dukakis is thinking about something that a friend of mine named Ralph Whitehead has begun to call the new collar voters. You know about the new collar voters? It's a new category that is sort of succeeding the blue collar voters. New collar voters are people defined as usually as families with two incomes, but employed not in the sort of yuppie professions, not in the well-paying professional strata, but in the sort of lower-paying service sector. That is, as Democrats think about their constituencies, I think that they have seen more and more that one of their old bases, the labor unions, and the industrial job base that the labor unions drew from, has shifted dramatically in the United States in the last 20 years. Labor union membership has plummeted. The base, therefore, that the Democratic Party counted on, particularly in northern cities, has shrunk considerably. Well, where are these people, or the equivalent of these people, today? Those were the old blue-collar folks, the steel mills, auto. My city, Chicago, lost 400,000 of those jobs, those industrial jobs, just in the last 15 years. What's in its place is a lot of service sector jobs that pay less and that require, for most families with children, two incomes to make it. So that Dukakis, following Ralph Whitehead, who's now at the University of Massachusetts and is a Democratic consultant, is thinking a lot about these new-collar families and how you appeal to the new-collar vote. Let me just digress here for a minute. One of the things that keeps me addicted to political life is the way in which new language emerges every 4 years in the elections. The new-collars are also referred to as ticks. Have you heard ticks? two-income couples with kids, ticks, right? And it's interesting that as Dukakis focuses on the ticks, so also we're beginning to see now, in ways that haven't been true for the Republicans throughout the 1980s, we're beginning to see George Bush do it too. So that right after the Democratic Convention, the next speech that George Bush made was a speech in which he proposed a $2.5 billion daycare program, right? An absolutely unheard of proposal from the point of view of the Reagan administration in the last 8 years. A beginning kind of move on Bush's part, I think, to distance himself from part of the Reagan legacy, particularly that part which is anathema to the ticks, to the new-collar voters, right? So both Dukakis and Bush are aware that there is a new set of voters out there that can't be appealed to in the same old ways, that some of the old kind of New Deal rhetoric for the Democrats and some of the 80s free enterprise rhetoric of the Republicans is going to miss these kinds of families, and it means a re-kind of definition of some of the social issues for both of them. Just another note or two on language. I also like the way, I'm always fascinated with the way candidates begin to label each other and sort of call each other names. My favorite for Dukakis so far, who obviously has some kind of a charisma problem, in addition to his Greek heritage, I suppose you've all heard him referred to as Zorba the Clerk. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. And I really did like Ann Richards' line about Bush at the Democratic Convention, that he was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
Yes.
If you're going to sling mud, you might as well do it with some humor and style. That's one of the things that's enjoyable about elections. Well, so Dukakis, I think, is beginning to figure out how to reposition the Democratic Party to bring in some voters that are as easily attracted to Republicans and have been, in fact, through most, it seems to me, of the Reagan years, certainly. Bush, of course, on his side, needs to do everything he possibly can to keep the Reagan coalition together. That is, to have a solid flank in the western United States, to lose none of the South, and to pull in one or two of the Midwestern states really on the basis of the social issue kind of campaign. And Bush has a very interesting and, I think, challenging tightrope to walk, because there are clearly from the polls, there are clearly some problems between the Reagan policies, particularly domestically, just the Reagan policies, and some of the core voting groups that the Reagan elections of 80 and 84 depended on. There's clearly some distance on the policy level, which has been made up, obviously, in the last 8 years by the incredible personal magnetism and appeal of Ronald Reagan himself. And Bush, of course, has to wonder whether that personal appeal and magnetism is transferable to a George Bush. That's seems to be a very questionable proposition, and so far it looks to me like the evidence is no, it's probably not, at least not totally transferable. So Bush is going to have to look for, in fact, concrete policy appeals like the $2.5 billion daycare proposal to attract voters which Ronald Reagan could attract on the basis of his personality and charisma. So those are the overall strategies, and it'll be fun, it seems to me, to figure out how Bush is going to move on the vice presidency with some kind of an understanding in our minds about what he needs to do geographically and in terms of the constituencies out there to win. It could be that Dukakis, with Benson, can set up enough of a... distance from the Reagan personality, and therefore, and programs as well, that we might be looking at a real pendulum swing that might mean at least in retrospect, thinking about 88 as a pivotal election. But we're going to talk about that a little bit more in a minute, probably. Let me just go to substance for a second as we let's leave the horse race for just a second, although substance and strategies are always totally intertwined. But another way of looking at an election, it seems to me, is to think about it as a sort of quadrennial public ritual, which substantively sets the agenda for discussion for the nation. What we find out in election time is what it's permissible to talk about and what it's not permissible to talk about, right? It seems to me that one of the real triumphs of the Reagan 8 years, from Ronald Reagan's own point of view, is that he has managed to redirect the public agenda, to reset the public conversation in such a way that it's quite impossible for most people to think in positive terms, for instance, about the role of the state, about the role of government. Now that's a massive redefinition of what it's okay to talk about. And it seems to me one of the real legacies of the Reagan years is that kind of refocusing on individual and entrepreneurial effort in the private sector rather than any kind of public life and thought about the public or governmental sector. That's a major triumph from Ronald Reagan's point of view. That's what he wanted to do, and he's done it. Now, are we going to be seeing some shifts in that way of thinking about what the public agenda is about? I think we are, and we're seeing it already. From my point of view, it seems to me that one of the things that Ronald Reagan's focus on privatism, on individual entrepreneurial effort, and on the dependence entirely on the private sector, one of the things that has done, not surprisingly, is to expose once again all of those areas in modern industrial capitalism where private enterprise is not very good at solving problems. I don't think one has to be anti-private enterprise to recognize that there are lots of areas in our life that corporations and private economic enterprise simply historically has not addressed, has not been able to deal with. Those areas, it seems to me, represent, taken together, a kind of agenda, kind of social and political agenda that has become more and more acute over the last 8 years, and which causes some hope in the Democratic Party. I'm thinking particularly of areas where the private sector has never done real well. For instance, low-income housing. There's just no profit to be made in the market approach to building low-income housing. So we've got none being built. And the gap between the available units of housing and those people who need housing is growing every year. So that in most cities it's recognized now as a kind of crisis. That's not something historically the private enterprise has been able to address. There are a lot of education agendas that private enterprise has not been able to address, from basic education, particularly in poor and low to moderate income neighborhoods, to some job preparation and training that is not specifically targeted to a particular corporation. Private industry has never been the way to get much of the infrastructure maintenance that's so key to our economy, in fact, done. There's not much interest in rebuilding sewers, rebuilding streets, rebuilding bridges, rebuilding transportation systems, providing for public transport, and so on, in private enterprise that at least needs some kind of cooperative public and private effort to get that done. It's clearer and clearer, it seems to me, that private enterprise is not the place to look if we're interested in health care for low and moderate income people. At least the indications are that is an agenda that the Reagan approach is not addressing very successfully at this point. And it's fairly clear, I think, by now, at least to lots and lots of voters, that environmental and energy-related concerns are not being adequately addressed by the private sector alone. So what I've just done is sort of give you a little laundry list of a bunch of substantive areas which it seems to me have fallen kind of between the cracks in Reagan's approach to how it is you handle public and social issues. And it seems to me that the Democrats are in a somewhat stronger position than they were in 1980 to argue that, at least in these areas, there is a necessary public role, a necessary governmental role, a necessary role for the state, if you will. Not the state acting alone, necessarily, and certainly not the state acting in a kind of top-down, authoritative, oppressive way, but at least some kind of cooperative efforts in these areas, and we could probably add some more. I need to make a footnote here that from my point of view in cities, I think that there are some salutary inheritances from the Reagan years. I think my own experience in cities with some of the poverty programs and some of the Great Society programs, not by any means all, but some, were that they were heavy-handed and top-down, and that they were, in some ways, dependency-creating. There's a kind of irony here that the Reagan administration, by removing government help from cities, has sort of allowed the space for lots of little enterprises to begin to spring up in neighborhoods and cities, particularly all over the country. Terrifically creative enterprises, little community-owned economic development outfits, a real burgeoning of neighborhood organizing efforts in poor and working class communities across the country, a kind of entrepreneurial spirit, which is what Reagan was talking about, sort of bubbling up from the bottom without any much, anyway, government help, whether from city, state, or federal government. So I have to say that, much as I'm not a Reagan person, there have been some elements of Reaganism, this sort of allowing of bubbling up from the bottom, that still appeal to me. And I have to resonate to Ronald Reagan's anti-bureaucratic rhetoric. Anybody who's ever dealt with public bureaucracies in a town like Chicago, or certainly in a town like Washington, D.C., has to resonate to that kind of rhetoric. And the Democratic Party, it seems to me, at least in some respects, has picked up on Reagan's anti-bureaucratic kind of rhetoric. I resonate to that part of Reaganism that calls for a kind of decentralism. It seems to me that we are at a point where we can rethink the relationship between decentralized power and centralized authority. What kind of dynamic are we working with here? It does seem to me that there's part of the Reagan legacy that allows us to rethink some stuff in really positive ways. So I have to make that caveat. I do think that all of these bubbling up things that are happening that I see as really positive need nurture, need resources. They're going no place without a lot of public commitment that helps them. But there are capacities out there, particularly in poor neighborhoods, that have been uncovered and that are out there for all to see, which we can build on, it seems to me. let me just say a word or two then. That's a sort of way of talking about how it seems to me anyway the public agenda domestically is being reformed. The public agenda in terms of foreign policy, I think, is also, and very, very importantly, up for grabs in this election. And it's part of what makes this election an important kind of time for us all. The link, it seems to me, that we need to think about in the Reagan heritage between domestic policy and foreign policy is the military budget. That is the incredible growth in the first 5 years, at least, of the Reagan presidency of the military expenditures, which of course has led us to the deficit situation which we face today, and which has basically capped or at least capped, if not reduced, a lot of the domestic programs aimed at low-income people. And has determined, the military budget that is, has determined a lot of how the Reagan administration has approached, it seems to me, foreign policy questions. My own view, though, is that there is a lot about Reagan's foreign policy that even George Bush would change, and that certainly Michael Dukakis would change more drastically. I think that that there has been a kind of reluctance in the Reagan administration to acknowledge how radically different the United States position globally is now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. Just think very briefly about the United States' relationship with the first world, the rest of the first world, with the second world, and with the third world. Who could have said 15 years ago that the United States, in relationship to other first world countries, particularly Europe and Japan, would be in the kind of position of really competitive equality, if not inferiority in some respects, right? That the trouble of the dollar, as against a variety of European currencies and the yen in particular, would be as pervasive as it has been. That in fact the whole Western capitalist economy of the first economies of the first world would be as intertwined as they are now, with multinationals moving across lines from the U.S. to Europe to Asia, with virtually no attention being paid to national boundaries. These are all developments that are relatively recent in U.S. history and call for, I think, quite a significant redefinition of who the United States is in regard to its relationships with the rest of the first world. Also, the relationship to the U.S. to the second world, that is, to the socialist world, and particularly to the Soviet Union itself, certainly to China in the last 10 or 15 years, has also shifted dramatically. And for that, I think, particularly in the last year and a half, we need to give Ronald Reagan some credit for moving from his evil empire kind of stance to a stance which has opened up some kind of dialogue, particularly between the Soviet Union and the United States. Of Reagan's foreign policy, that they're not able to think much beyond that kind of narrow east-west view of the entire world. And of course, one of the things that does is to really lead to some serious misreading and underestimation of all of the north-south dynamics on the globe today, right? So that it's harder and harder for the Reagan administration, it seems to me, to understand the complexities and dynamics of North and South, because they insist still on reading all of North and South as if it were a part of East and West, right? So that the complexities of the United States relationship to all of the different Central American countries and all of the different South American countries, certainly all of Africa in all of its variety, and to a variety of Asian countries, all of those relationships are shifting radically. The Reagan administration, it seems to me, needs to, it's begun to, but Bush would move even further, and Dukakis probably further than him, in, it seems to me, beginning to focus on North and South. North and South as dynamics that are in and of themselves important and definitive for foreign policy. And that would be a hugely significant kind of shift, because the U.S. in relationship to the third world has less power than we did 15 years ago. That is, we have less control over what happens in the third world. The debt between the third world and particularly the United States and other parts of the first world has escalated to the point where even the Reagan administration calls that a crisis, right? And some way needs to be found to mitigate that debt relationship. There is more independence on the part of more national embodiments in the third world from the United States influence than there was 15 years ago, and that's a part of the reality that needs to be recognized in the 90s, it seems to me. We can ask then what kind of creative responses would either the Bush or Dukakis camps have to those developments. So, in summary, both on the substantive level, it seems to me, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy, there are hugely important things on the table, and insofar as this is a time about the shifting of agendas, the shifting of discussions, we could be sitting right in the middle of a quite significant historic moment in the United States and its public life. Okay, lastly, a word about symbols and symbolic politics. This is partly, it's partly just something that fascinates me, but it's also, it seems to me, an absolutely key area to think about if we want to understand how United States politics works and how it gets mediated by the media, how we how we and the media and political strategists interact. So let me just talk for a minute about symbolic politics and then see if we can talk about it in the context of the 88 election. A symbol in political life can be thought about as a sign pointing to and understood by many to be pointing to something of larger significance, something of substance. A symbol in political life can be a person. In fact, most public figures, when they get known well enough, begin to stand for something, begin to point to a reality beyond themselves. Certainly, we could begin to think about Ronald Reagan and the kind of symbolic father figure for a good number of Americans that Ronald Reagan represents. Symbolism attaches itself to people, but it also attaches itself to acts, so that a variety of acts in the political realm need to be read not just as something people did, but as symbolically important. I think, for instance, of the attention given to whether or not Michael Dukakis called up Jesse Jackson to tell Jackson about the choice of Lloyd Benson as his vice presidential running mate. Obviously, that act of calling Jesse Jackson had no significance in and of itself. It was a symbol of how it is the dance between Dukakis and Jackson was going to go at this point, right? It was symbolic of an entire relationship, set of power relationships between peoples, right, within the political process. It stood for much more than just a phone call. Symbols are important in our daily lives like that, too. It probably is symbolically more important for all of us to call our mothers once in a while than it is substantively important to find out how breakfast was or whatever you talk to your mother about most of the time, right? I mean, we all engage in symbolic acts with each other constantly. All I'm saying is that on the public stage and in the political realm, those acts really do carry a terrific amount of weight. And much of running a campaign, much of thinking about positioning candidates, is a thinking about how those symbols get formulated and read by the public. So you can think about politics partly as the craft of manipulating existing symbols, right? Or in fact, of creating new ones that communicate to enough of a public, in fact, to take on some kind of a symbolic status. Let's think about the particular race that we're at the presidential level just for a second with that kind of symbolic set of categories in the background. Dukakis, I wrote an article about the Democratic presidential candidates in January when there were seven of them, and what I basically, I tried to figure out where they were on the policy spectrum and what sort of proposals they were about presenting at that point. And at that point, I was basically arguing you have to talk about Jesse Jackson in a kind of separate category because of all of the weight that he carries, and we'll talk about that in just a second, the weight of constituencies as well as substantive policies. But the other six at that point, Dukakis was clearly on the left of the other six candidates, the six white candidates that went into Iowa for the first set of primaries. It's terrifically interesting, it seems to me, from a political perspective and a symbolic perspective, to think about what Dukakis has done since then, to position himself closer and closer to the center of the Democratic Party. Right? It was really, from that point of view, very important for him to distance himself from Jesse Jackson on the left, right? And to make sure that for the kinds of votes that he needs, he thinks, to get over the top, to be attracted to him, that he was no longer identified with the liberal wing of the party. So he's marching into November, right smack in the center, with Jesse Jackson on his left and Lloyd Benson on his right, right? A candidate who is interested in getting a majority of votes, from Dukakis' point of view and from the point of view of his campaign managers, that's exactly where he wants to be, symbolically right in the middle. and therefore able to attract, as long as relationships are good with both the right and the left of the Democratic Party, able to attract votes from both ends. Think too about the symbolism around Dukakis of his ethnic background. I think in lots of ways this is the most ethnic Democratic ticket of the century. That is, Dukakis as a second generation Greek immigrant, married to a Jewish woman, both of whom celebrate their ethnic heritages, use them as assets. It seems to me symbolically what that's about is appealing to a kind of sense of, partly to kind of sense of lost community in the American public. That is, we're talking here about roots. We're talking here about belonging to something that has an identity beyond the individual. And there are lots of indications that the American people, at least large segments of them, are hungry for that kind of communal identification. It's about a valuing of tradition, both the Jewishness and the Greekness of the Dukakis couple. It's about partly this sort of American myth of coming from humble roots and leading to the White House, of the immigrant child going to the White House. We should be a little bit wary of that kind of business, as Mike Royko in a column of about 10 days ago reminded us that both Michael Dukakis and his father went to Harvard in graduate school, right? So we're not talking right off the boat here. But we are talking about the manipulation of symbols. We're talking about the manipulation of symbols and impressions and the way in which that gets read. It's interesting, I was working a little bit with the Jackson campaign the early part of the winter, in December and January, and Jackson at that point, with six white candidates in the race, said that he was most at home with Dukakis, that there was something about the groupness of Dukakis' ethnic identity that Jackson found attractive and interesting and sympathetic in some way, that there was a way in which he felt, we were just talking about how Jackson would measure up against a variety of different candidates, and he was saying that he thought more of the voters that he was used to appealing to, and particularly black voters, would resonate to the Dukakis ethnic thing. Because of its community kind of identity and its communal sort of reality. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's one of the things that that Jackson will begin sort of explaining in his role now as cross-cultural communicator in the Democratic Party. It's an interesting race because that communal rooted traditional set of identities on the Democratic side really does contrast quite markedly with who George Bush is, right? I think it's probably a problem for the Republicans. I'm not quite sure, but it's, you know, George Bush is somebody who can't figure out what state he's from. It's not quite clear what his, you know, ethnic background is. He comes across as the sort of quintessential individual American success story, but very individual. Moving, he's got a huge long resume of successful stints in a variety of governmental positions and variety of governmental bureaucracies, and that kind of rampant individualism that a Bush stands for, the mobility, the success, the at-homeness in the rarefied world of Washington bureaucracies really does contrast with the kind of image, now we're talking symbols and images here, that Dukakis and Dukakis, Pence, and Jackson are projecting. So it's that at the symbolic level we're talking about two really very different views of where leadership should come next in the United States. It'll be interesting to see now as the cameras shift to the Republican convention and Bush gets a chance now to be in the limelight and to shape his own set of symbols, to see what he does, to see how it is that he counters this kind of communal image that Dukakis is working on. And again, the question is, can he follow the master of rugged individualism, Ronald Reagan, who somehow has managed to embody rugged individualism, but in a way that connects fatherly with lots and lots of people in the country? That's a tricky tightrope, it seems to me, for George Bush to have to walk. Finally, just let me end and then invite all kinds of discussion. Hopefully, let me just say a word or two, particularly as going to Rainbow Week here, but also because it's important, about the Jackson campaign. I think that so far, given we're on August 1st, 1988, if historians were to think about the 1988 elections and what is the most historically significant set of events so far in this election, there is absolutely no doubt that it's been the campaign and impact of Jesse Jackson that is historically the most important thing so far about the 1988 elections. Jackson has brought into the mainstream political arena and into the life of the Democratic Party, at least for the present, what looks like some 2.5 million voters who would not have voted had Jesse Jackson not been running. It's a huge number of people in the primary so far. Not only has he expanded the roles of the Democratic Party in the traditionally most difficult registration and voting populations. That is, we all know about the statistics that say people register and vote at greater numbers the more wealthy they are, and the higher the education level. So when we're talking about poor people and poor people in places where there are not great school systems and when there are high dropout rates, we're talking about the toughest set of populations to involve in the electoral process. We're talking about hopelessness. And we're talking about a candidacy that, for lots and lots of people who have been hopeless, embodied some kind of hope. We're talking about a candidacy that united some elements, certainly within the black community, that are often not united. More and more, of course, as we're all aware, the separation of the very poor in our cities from the middle class of all races, including black, which has been taking place for the last 15 years. Jesse Jackson comes along and reunites that, at least in a political moment, for the time being. Jesse Jackson not only has built in more participation in the electoral process from the bottom, but he has also, interestingly enough, expanded his own appeal and the appeal of at least part of his policy stances to other people of color constituencies, particularly Hispanics, but also significant numbers of Asians and Native Americans as well. But he's also increasingly, of course, picked up white votes, both white professional votes and, in some surprising numbers in some states, white blue-collar and new-collar votes. That's probably the most surprising element of Jackson's campaign in '88, and the place in which Jackson's campaign has shifted most from '84 to '88. Finally, Jesse Jackson, it seems to me, has represented, at least for large numbers of people in the black community across the United States and others who have worked in civil rights, a transition between what could be called movement politics and government or electoral politics. It is obviously the roots of Reverend Jackson go back to the civil rights movement, both in the South and in the North, and he has managed to take some of the style, some of the rhetoric, and a lot of the issues that were defined by a social movement, which by definition is an outsider phenomenon. It's an outsider phenomenon, social movement is always. Taking some of those and bringing those onto the main stage of American electoral politics. It's a terrific trick, I think seldom done, and probably never done with the amount of success that Jackson has had this year in doing that. So it's clear to me anyway, for a large number of reasons, and some of which we I haven't even mentioned, that so far anyway, the historically most interesting and significant set of developments this year has been the Jackson campaign. No matter what you think about Jackson, whether you agree with him or not, whether you agree partly or not at all, that, it seems to me, needs to be noted. So, let me stop. I think that, just to sum up in one sentence, I think that in terms of both the substance and the possible symbolic shift going on in the American public arena and psyche, mass psyche at this point, in all of its complications, that 1988 is, in fact, a most significant electoral year, and could be, when we get about to 96 and can look back a couple of elections, could be, in fact, one of those elections that political scientists look at as really somehow embodying a plate tectonic kind of shift in the American public mind. So let me stop there and invite comments or questions or disagreements or whatever else here and here. Yes, sir.
The impression I get from reading the papers and all that kind of thing right now, and we still have one more convention coming up.
Yep.
I sense just the opposite, that a lot of people are going kind of ho-hum about this whole thing, saying, you know, you've got basically carbon copies of each other, both are kind of dull, you know, presidential candidates, they don't have much charisma and all that kind of thing. And so it's been interesting to hear what has been to me a little bit different approach. And I was just asked, interested in your comments on that. Am I reading that correctly?
I don't think I'm not sure I disagree much with that. I'm not really talking about how the American people are responding to each of the candidates as sort of charisma barometers, right? In which case we would probably get a reading exactly like the one you're reporting. Neither sort of exudes a kind of excitement, but neither did in lots of ways neither did Humphrey and Nixon in '68. I'm really talking about a set of dynamics, a set of shifts of constituencies and agendas that transcend who these people are as individuals and what their personalities are. Our life. But I agree with you.
I hadn't heard a whole lot of that either.
Yeah.
Of course, maybe it's the papers I'm reading.
You're saying there's been a whole lot of interest.
Let me go here first and then over here, okay? Yes, ma'am.
What is your opinion about Michael Dukakis, and also what is your opinion of Jesse Jackson? I read an editorial about Jackson that the mayor of Chicago wasn't a big enough job for him.
Well, I mean, I'm a Chicagoan, and I've crossed paths and worked for and with and around Jesse Jackson for 20 years. I think that Chicago, let me just take your second question first. Chicago is Jesse's toughest town. That's not unusual. It's often the case that public figures have their toughest publics in their hometowns. I mean, he's been around there longer, and therefore he's made more controversial moves, and he's made more enemies, and he's made more waves in lots of ways.
From the editorial, it was saying that, you know, Jackson was aiming for the highest, and the job of mayor of Chicago wouldn't be big enough for him.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think that he doesn't think he could be elected mayor of the city of Chicago, and I think that that's probably right. He's never been a major electoral player on the city level in Chicago. He's always been a much more, he's either dealing at the community level, or he's dealing with national kinds of issues. So there's a sense in which he's been a player on the national scene much more than he's been a player in Chicago's electoral political scene. So I'm not sure it's a question of not wanting to shoot higher than the Chicago mayor's office. It's just that that's where he's been a player, and that's where he's at home. Dukakis, I don't know personally. I've met him at a couple of receptions in Chicago. My friends in Boston, who have worked with and around him for the last, you know, he was a one-term governor in Massachusetts, was defeated, and then came back and ran again and won again, right? So that there was a term where he was not governor of Massachusetts. And that defeat apparently tempered his views and his persona as a politician quite a lot. What my friends, who tend to be sort of more activist and urban-oriented people, say about Dukakis is that, number one, he's not afraid of good people. That his he will surround himself with talented folks. Some, you know, some leaders are just afraid of having people who are smarter than them around them. Dukakis is not that way, apparently. The other thing that they say about him is that he is usually responsive to issues when they get defined by constituencies and brought to him, but that he's not as good at initiating policy directions, but he can be quite responsive if organized constituencies with agendas come at it. Then he'll respond. Basically, the community organizing and activist groups that I know in Massachusetts have more good things than bad to say about Dukakis. So that's all I know at this point. Yes, ma'am.
I just want to get your opinion on if we all want so very much to attack the social issues, but we also want to pass on to our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, a terrific national debt. And we had hoped that Ronald Reagan, in his camp before he was elected, he had said that he was going to cut out the debt or help it, and he hasn't done that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that in this election, the social issues are so very important, but we don't hear the candidates talking about cutting down the debt. We thought that Bob Dole was saying something about that, but that they aren't trying to balance it so that we don't give this terrific burden to our grandchildren.
Yeah. I suspect that, you know, both parties are going to have to, and probably the Democrats will go a little bit further than this, but they can't say it. It's one of the things you can't talk about in the public agenda in American politics at this point is anything honest about taxes. You just can't talk about taxes. I think that, you know, everybody in both the Bush and Dukakis camp recognize that the next president is going to raise taxes. It's just clear. Republicans will do it, the Democrats will do it. You have to. There'll probably be slightly different packages. But it is part of the definition of what's possible to talk about that you don't talk about that. They will raise taxes. Both Republicans and Democrats will do that. I think probably the Democrats, all the Republicans also, but the Democrats will go a little bit further in capping the military budget, the growth of the military budget, which most analysts, at least on the Democratic side, think has been the major contributor to the growth of the deficit. And that, in fact, as we've learned now in the last couple of months, the amount of just sheer waste and some graft going on in the military budget would, if just that were cut out, as Republican David Packard tells us, would go some direction to attacking the deficit. Yes, sir.
I kind of feel a little bit awkward with Dukakis and the way that he treated Jackson in this letting him know, alerting him to the fact that he had chosen someone else as a running mate. Not because Dukakis didn't make what was could be considered an excellent choice for a running mate, but the fact that he was playing hardball with someone who has to be his ally. And if in fact he's really sensitive to the issues and sensitive to this emerging new electorate, if he's really sensitive to that, how could he do such a thing? I think it was really an insensitive way of handling it. And if he is able to handle things that insensitively in such a key issue, how will he really feel? What is his real motivation in the social issues? What is his real motivation? Is he really just a political person who is going to do the best thing for himself politically? Or is he really concerned about some of these social issues in which a great deal of money is going to have to be spent and a lot of effort is going to have to be expended?
Yeah. It's a real good question. My assumption is that slight was not just insensitivity, but that slight was very well calculated and a part of the campaign strategy. I think that Dukakis reads the electoral votes in a way that has persuaded him that he had to move away from Jackson, distance himself, partly to reappeal to white ethnic voters, these new collar voters, some of the folks who voted for Reagan. The Democrats need those people back, and I think Dukakis quite consciously and his managers took a number of steps to distance themselves from Reverend Jackson. And, you know, that's something that the dance between Jackson and Dukakis is a fascinating one at this point, because Jackson is in the position which black folks are often in, at least have been since 1936 in the United States, of not really, for most of them, feeling like the Republican Party is an option. And therefore, if they are to be taken for granted by the Democrats, how much does Dukakis have to do to keep them on board? My own feeling is that Jackson can affect black turnout in massive ways, right, by being enthusiastic, lukewarm, disappearing, or even being occasionally hostile. and I think Dukakis recognizes that, but he also recognizes that there are lots of people in the U.S., some of whom the Democrats need to be voting for them, who really can't stand, for racist and other reasons, all of anything to do with Jesse Jackson. And that's a tough tightrope for him to walk. You've had a chance. Let me go to Dumasani for just a second.
Yeah, yes, following on that, even though I don't quite agree, one of the things Reagan did very well, I mean, not that I agree with him, was that Reagan proved that you could become president without the black vote.
Yes.
I mean, twice he didn't. For two elections, one of the studies have shown that there were not even any blacks in any of the Reagan commercials, both in 80, and there was one black person who they caught by accident because she was a policeman. But I mean, he ran commercials that didn't have black people, and he didn't in any way try even to appease black people. In all the dinners they've had in the White House, they've had a total of less than 10 black guests. I mean, except for musicians, we have to entertain them. But I mean, he has proven. I mean, he has, in a very, very smart, calculated political way, that you can do without the black vote, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And but Reagan is Reagan. I mean, he did it very well. What are the chances of George Bush putting up that kind of coalition? What are the chances of? I mean, it's significant in the sense that what we'll be talking about this whole week about Reagan is insensitive on South Africa and whatever, but Reagan is being consistent. Yes, I mean, he's insensitive about blacks here. Why should he care about America? and he's not hiding it. I mean, he's being very open. What are the chances of the two guys, either Dukakis or everybody, pulling off that kind of thing, which they can? I mean, it's legal. There's nothing wrong with that. What are the chances of
it? Well, it's a numbers game, isn't it? In lots of ways, it seems to me. And one of the variables is how many black votes the Democrats can get. But I don't think that there's much, I don't think that as George Bush puts his strategy together, he wants to do anything more than replicate what Reagan has done, I think, right? I mean, I'm not sure that he's going to be any more visibly attaching himself to black Republicans. There are some around, than Reagan. Do you? I don't.
Well,
I doubt it.
It's curious. I mean, I'm just...
Yeah, but you're right. You're absolutely right. Those two campaigns in 80 and 84 were probably the two whitest campaigns of the 20th century.